Welcome to the first episode of Year 2 of Law and Religion Down Under. I'm your host, Jeremy Patrick. This bi-monthly podcast is devoted to exploring the myriad of ways that law and religion can interact. Each episode of Law and Religion Down Under features an interview with a different guest drawn from across the spectrum of religions and ideologies. In this episode, my guest is Newcastle University Associate Professor Neil Foster. Neil has a background in law and theology and writes the blog Law and Religion Australia. He's on the show today to speak about a new bill that recently passed through both houses of the Victorian Parliament. The Equal Opportunity Religious Exceptions Amendment Bill would change the current laws in the state about whether religious groups can make decisions that take into account an individual's sex, sexual orientation, and gender identity. Neil, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
That's right, Jeremy. It's my pleasure. My pleasure indeed.
So before we get into the details of this new law and how it's going to work and change things, can you sort of set the stage and explain what the situation was like in Victoria prior to this law? Who could a religious organization hire and fire? How were GLBTIQ plus students treated and so forth?
Yeah, sure. So in Victoria, this material is dealt with under the Equal Opportunity Act 2010. And actually, that act is still in its current form. The amendments won't happen for about 6 months to 12 months. So under the current form, part of the background of this is that discrimination laws all over Australia recognise that there's a need to balance rights not to be discriminated against with rights of religious freedom. Both of those are important human rights that are accepted internationally as things that people enjoy and should enjoy. And so we in Australia don't have very robust protection of religious freedom at the moment. And one of the ways that's achieved, though, is through putting what I've called balancing clauses into discrimination legislation to balance out the rights of one party to have their religious freedom recognised with the rights of others not to be discriminated against. Those things can, in some contexts, run up against each other. So those provisions are in the Victorian Equal Opportunity Act. And at the moment, they're contained in sections 82, 83 and 84 of the Victorian legislation. In broad terms, section 82 says that where you've got a religious body, that it won't commit an act of discrimination where it applies, first of all, its own religious beliefs to appointment of clergy or religious office holders. So the classic example, I guess, is that people had to take into account the long-standing tradition of Roman Catholic Church only appointing male priests. And how do we go with that? And do we allow autonomy to churches to make their own decisions on these various criteria? So that's one part of the Victorian law, 82.1. And then 82.2 goes a bit beyond priests and clergy and office holders to other decisions that might be made by organisations. And in broad terms, section 82.2, as it stands at the moment, lets religious bodies make decisions which would otherwise be regarded as discriminatory on the basis of sexual orientation, lawful sexual activity, marital status, parental status, gender identity, those sorts of things, where those decisions conform with the doctrines, beliefs and principles of the body or are reasonably necessary to avoid injury to religious sensitivities. So those are two ways of framing religious freedom decisions which are allowed under the legislation at the moment. And that will include things like employment. So a religious school may say, let's take one example. There may be a staff member employed by a religious school which holds conservative, what one might call traditional biblical moral principles, and they don't appreciate the fact the staff member might be setting a bad example to students by living in a de facto relationship. A bloke may be living with his girlfriend or something like that. And so the school may say, well, this is a criterion that we will apply based on our religious beliefs. And at the moment, they're allowed to do that. And they're allowed to make decisions which are consistent with their ethos, as this term sometimes used, with the faith commitments that lie behind why the school has been set up. Section 83 of the legislation allows similar rules to be applied specifically by religious schools. It's a slightly unusual thing in that you've got 82 applying broadly to religious bodies, 83 applying to religious schools. But I think the reason for the distinction is that sometimes a school that's meant to operate on religious principles might not be currently run by a religious body. There might be a historical school that's meant to operate on religious principles but is now not operated by an actual church. Anyway, for whatever reason, 83 applies similar rules. And the other feature of the Victorian law is Section 84 allows individuals to be exempt from discrimination actions where they make decisions in accordance with their own individual religious commitments. So, yeah, so that's the way that it's currently set out.
Okay, so to provide a little bit of context, I guess, for people brand new to this area, we know every state has an anti-discrimination sort of law that prohibits discrimination in certain areas, whether it's employment or schooling or government offerings, on all sorts of bases, race and disability and sex, and increasingly in recent decades, things like sexual orientation, gender identity, and so forth. Yep. And the provisions you're talking about provide a sort of carve out, an exemption for religious bodies to be able to continue to make choices on certain protected characteristics. Is that a fair sort of summary?
Yeah, that's right. And there's a bit of debate as to whether they should be called exemptions or whether they should be regarded as something else. In fact, we won't go into that now, but the new religious discrimination bill in the federal parliament takes a slightly different approach and just says this is not discrimination. And that's kind of the way. But anyway, the idea is, yes, we're balancing out these different rights. And so religious bodies have been given the right to make decisions, which if they were made by other people on different grounds would not be lawful, but recognizing the need of religious bodies to, as it were, or to put it another way, the right of religious people to join together in organizations that reflect their faith commitments, which is recognized, as I say, in international law, and allow people to live and operate organizations in that way.
Well, and as you say, these sort of, whether we call them exemptions or freedoms or however you want to phrase them for religious groups, have existed since the beginning of public accommodation laws or anti-discrimination laws, however you want to phrase them. Because, you know, we don't want a restaurant saying it's only going to hire men, but we would presumably want the Catholic Church to be able to say it's only going to have male priests. That is the understanding for why religious groups receive a particular carve out or exemption or benefit in these laws. So these laws are anti-discrimination laws generally are present throughout Australia. Was the way Victoria was handling things pretty similar to the other states in Australia, or was it different, at least before this new law came about?
In broad terms, I would say it was quite similar to most of the other legislation around Australia. There are some laws which are actually a little bit narrower than the Victorian law in the terms of the accommodation that they offer to religious groups. The Tasmanian law, for example, has some very narrowly confined recognition of religious freedoms. And so, for example, the Tasmanian Anti-Discrimination Act 1998 doesn't really give any recognition for a religious body to make a decision which could be characterised actually as on the ground of gender identity or sexual orientation. And even its recognition of a body's right to make a distinction based on sex is very narrow. So, yeah, there are narrower versions. Tasmania in particular is a fairly narrow one. But on the whole, the Victorian model was generally consistent with the rest of the country. And in fact, one has to say that it was, or currently is, for the moment, more generous to religious individuals, because Section 84 of the Victorian legislation is not really replicated in most of the other Australian laws, in the sense that the view's been taken by parliaments that we will give these accommodations to religious bodies, but they've not often given that directly to religious individuals freedom for them to act in accordance with their faith. Whereas Section 84 of the Victorian legislation at the very present time does actually allow some accommodation for individuals as opposed to bodies.
So at least before this new law, would it be fair to say religious groups or individuals were fairly satisfied with the status quo in Victoria when it comes to, as you say, balancing these sort of difficult matters?
Well, perhaps what's the word that's a little bit less than satisfied, but able to rub along with them. Okay.
You know? Okay, fair enough. Yeah. Okay.
Accepting that this is the way things were, I think religious groups generally saw that there was room for improvement in some of these areas. But yeah, overall, I would say it represents an approach that has been acknowledged on both sides of various debates, and people have been prepared to live with it. And even the individual, the fact that individuals don't have protection around most of Australia, has been accepted by people in our country as just the way things are. So yeah, apart from the, as I say, I think the Tasmanian law operating fairly harshly in relation to religious bodies, the overall I would say religious groups have been able to work with the law as it stands.
Well, go ahead and talk about this new law and sort of how it changes the status quo in Victoria. And we should clarify for listeners, there's been a lot of media attention about two different bills in Victoria in 2021. One had to do with so-called gay conversion therapy and banning that as a practice. And we're going to set that law aside for now. We're not talking about that one. But how does this new law change the anti-discrimination regime as it applies to religious bodies in Victoria?
Yeah, so the effect of the what we'll call the religious exemptions law, I guess, is to really reduce situations or to tightly limit situations where religious bodies, in particular religious schools, can apply codes of conduct that they would like to apply in their operations to staff, and also to limit the way that those codes of conduct can be applied to students. And so it shrinks the sort of areas where a religious school can operate in accordance with its religious commitments. And I mean, one of the features of this area is that a religious commitment is not just about what I believe on a Sunday or what I believe about the structure of the universe. It's about how I live day by day. And religious schools, the ethos or the reason, as it were, the raison d'etre for the religious schools is that parents want their children to receive an education which is consistent with their fundamental religious commitments, and to see a modelling of their values as well as the teaching. So the teaching of sort of mainstream subjects in Christian schools or religious schools around Australia is basically the same as you'll get in most secular schools. The physics and the maths and the social sciences in many ways will be very similar, history, etc. But along with that, the parents want teaching about their religious tradition, but also they see it on the whole as an important part, and certainly many religious schools will see it as an important part, that the staff model a lifestyle that's consistent with their religious commitments. And so what we have in this situation is that there's a real narrowing of the ability of schools to make these decisions, to the extent that this will even apply, for example, to a religious studies teacher who is, you know, employed to convey the truths of the faith, but the school will not, under the Victorian changes, not be able to make a decision to discipline or instruct or remove that teacher if that teacher has a fundamental, as it were, a change of views on their moral behaviour. And so they may, as I say, start living with a girlfriend or something like that. But if, you know, under this legislation, that will be harder for the school to say, well, this person who's meant to be teaching our religion to the children is, you know, as it were, inconsistent in the way they're living that out. And yet we're required to keep them on because of the way the legislation is set up. So that's a real problem for many faith-based schools, I think, that they will no longer be able to say all the members of the staff share the ethos that we have. I mean, if I can just broaden it out a little bit,
sure.
My understanding is that, for example, good management theory for corporations over the last couple of decades has said, look, what you want is people in your corporation who share the corporate vision. You want people who are on board with the way the company is moving. You want people who are, you know, enthusiastic about the general values of the company. And that's a truth that applies to schools as well as to businesses. And that sort of view that you want people who are working for you to share the corporate ethos, share the the ethos is a very important one. And of course, it applies to groups like political parties. So the ALP is not required to employ a One Nation person to work in their office. It applies to lobby groups who are particularly angling for, you know, certain outcomes. The environmental groups are not required to employ someone who's a dyed-in-the-wool coal miner or something like that. So we're talking about a general principle which is very important for many organisations. And Christian schools are about organisations that have particular commitments about issues of wider general behaviour and morality rather than just making a profit. I mean, that's not what they're on about fundamentally.
Sure. I wonder if you could, I guess for those of us who aren't versed in the legal intricacies, sort of clarify what could these religious schools or religious bodies do before the law that they can't do after the law in a sort of down to tax sort of way, if that's possible.
Well, I'll do my best. So, and of course, a lot of this involves speculation going on, but of course, you have to go on the wording of the legislation. So, under the new proposals, there are changes to Section 82 of the Victorian legislation, which say that the broad principles about allowing groups to make decisions in accordance with their faith won't apply to staffing decisions. And so there's a new Section 82 capital A under the law, and it says if you want to discriminate against another person, or if you want to make decisions in relation to a staff member, then you're allowed to discriminate on the basis of their religious belief or activity, but not on the basis of any other attribute. So that is certainly a very tight narrowing. So a school which previously, as I say, might have said, well, the staff members living with their de facto partner is outside the code of conduct that we expect of our staff members, that would be discrimination on the basis of marital status now, and it would not be covered by the exemption under the legislation, and so the school would not be able to ask that person to either, you know, well, not to say to that person, you can't work for us anymore. So so the discrimination can only be on the basis of religious belief or activity. 82A says also, so there's the number of conditions under 82A under which you may discriminate against somebody. First of all, it has to be on the basis of religion, not on the basis of some other attribute. 82.1A says that you must show that conformity to the religion is an inherent requirement of the position. And then thirdly, you must also show that the discrimination is reasonable and proportionate in the circumstances. Now, those at first glance sound okay to some extent, inherent requirement. Yeah, that's what we're talking about. But the big question to my mind comes in who makes that decision? Who decides that something is an inherent requirement of a particular position? And at the moment, the way the law is worded, it's up to the religious group to decide, well, we as a group have an ethos that every member of staff should, for example, perhaps be able to lead the Bible study in the morning. Every member of staff should be able to explain their faith to students, or every member of staff should be setting a model example of how adults live out their faith. They may take the view that that's important. A secular tribunal may say, well, no, all you've got to do to teach maths at this school is to know maths. That should be your only requirement. And so our view is that it's not an inherent requirement that this maths teacher, for example, be someone who shares the religious or moral commitments of this organisation. And then not only inherent requirement is required then, but this other wording of reasonable and proportionate. And so I think in one of the posts that I've written, give you a slightly far-fetched example, but we could take the example of an Islamic school who employs an Islamic studies teacher, and that person decides that they'll become a Christian. And you may say, well, it's pretty obvious that that's an inherent requirement of the teaching in the Muslim school that you, you know, be a Muslim. But they may go to the secular tribunal and say, well, you know, no, I get on with the students. So I'm prepared to teach from the Quran. It's not reasonable and proportionate for you to remove me from my position, even though I've now made a fundamental decision which goes contrary to everything your school believes. I can still do this. I can still teach. The reasonable and proportionate decision then again ultimately comes to a decision made by a tribunal or a court that will have to consider the matter. So, basically, I think one of the issues in this area is subjecting the decision making of religious bodies to outside groups who may or may not understand the basis for it and may not share that commitment.
So to unpack that a little bit, it sounds like there's sort of three big changes. One is that the discrimination is allowed only if it's on the basis of religious belief or identity. So as you say, a Catholic school can decide it's only going to have Catholic teachers and not Protestant teachers, but it can't say no gay teachers or no unmarried teachers. And then the second thing is about the scope of, at least for employees, who counts as an employee who kind of fits within that, I can't remember the phrase.
Inherent requirement.
Is it
an inherent requirement of this?
Right.
So as well as it being a religious decision, is it also an inherent requirement that the person...
So we might think, a priest is, it's inherently a requirement that you have the same religious identity as the church. But the classic example, I guess a groundskeeper, we might say it, the church doesn't need to make sure the groundskeeper are Catholic if it's a Catholic church hiring them to do that. But I know there's been some argument on the other side saying that every employee of the religious organization needs to be able to share and demonstrate the ethos of that organization in order for, I guess, the organization or the community around that organization to really come together with shared values and a shared sense of purpose and so forth. And then the third example you mentioned is, or the third perhaps change or issue with it is this idea that it's going to be a secular administrative tribunal deciding whether it's really necessary to make this what might be perceived as a discriminatory choice to exclude someone on this basis. That raises concerns about who's making the decision and are they going to be bringing in the right factors to make this sort of balancing factor?
Indeed. And it has to be said that the tribunals, well, a tribunal in Victoria has made a very controversial decision in the past in the CYC and Cobourg case where the tribunal ruled in a way which seemed to many people to be taking on authority to determine religious doctrine. The tribunal member in that case was dealing with you're familiar with the case, but I'll just briefly mention it for our listeners. Christian Youth Camps in Cobourg was a Victorian case where a Christian youth camping organisation declined a booking from a group which was designed to further and teach young people about the rightness and goodness of same-sex relationships. It was something that the Christian Youth Camping Organisation disagreed with. But when they were trying to use one of these balancing clauses from the Victorian law, the tribunal said, well, the tribunal took it on itself to say, I have to determine what really is a part of your doctrine or not. And when the tribunal examined the doctrinal documents, while there was a commitment to the truth of the Bible, there was no explicit statement about sexual morality. And so the tribunal was, oh, well, I've got to take expert evidence. And so two experts were brought from completely opposite, as it were, ends of the theological spectrum. And the tribunal member accepted the evidence of the what one might call the liberal theologian who said, oh, yes, sex has got nothing to do with doctrine and therefore, doctrine's all about the Nicene Creed and other things like that. We don't need to apply sexual conduct rules. And therefore, the tribunal member took it on themselves to say, well, this view about same-sex relationships is not a part of your doctrine. Now, that's an illustration of how things can go.
I agree. That
authority is taken on.
Clearly problematic for a court or tribunal to sort of second guess someone and say your beliefs aren't really your beliefs. Tend to test whether the beliefs are sincerely held, but not to say your beliefs aren't legitimately part of your supported by the doctrine or something like that. That I agree. that seems very problematic as far as it goes. We should also say that this new law, we've been talking about it in the context of employees. It also says that government-funded religious bodies can't discriminate in their service offerings, and that religious schools can't exclude students for being gay or transgender, for example. I think, you know, at least in the media, a lot of the discussion I see about this tends to really focus on this issue of, can religious schools kick out students for being gay? Can we find a balance between the religious ethos of a school or an organization and the need to treat people fairly regardless of their sexuality or gender identity? And you know, there has been a lot of discussion in the press about how difficult it is for adolescents to come to grips with their sexual orientation or gender identity, how psychologically harmful or damaging it can be to live in fear that if anyone finds out who you really are, you're going to be kicked out of school. And I think maybe that sort of underpins a lot of the reason this legislation was put into place, the purpose for it. I guess, what do you think about that sort of concern by those who want equality and want to protect youth from feeling that, you know, when they come to grips with who they are, they're going to face punishment by their peers or their school or something like that?
Yeah, it is a very, very tricky issue, I think, because we have to, I think there's no denying that the view of sexual morality that's adopted in some religious organizations that are following their fundamental beliefs is inconsistent with the view that homosexual activity is all fine. There's a view that the traditional religious view from many of the foundational documents, Bible, Torah, the Quran, is that God's purposes for humanity are not that people engage in homosexual activity, that sexual activity is, it's not just a question of saying homosexuality, sexual activity generally is to be expressed in the context of a man-woman marriage. And so that's a view that's very unpopular amongst many people. And so you've got a situation where parents are sending children along to schools where they hope that the schools will be teaching and encouraging students to see the goodness of this worldview that they believe is really important and is true. And you've got then a tension there with the way students feel. The fact is, I probably should say right up front, I don't think that there are many, if any, students who have been expelled from religious schools because of their sexual orientation. It does not seem to be a practice that is very common. I mean, one can hardly imagine that it wouldn't be on the front page of the papers if it was happening every day. It's not happening every day. I don't, of course, know every situation that's happened around the country, but it is not a very common thing. Mostly the schools and people I've spoken to will wrestle with helping students to understand the faith, helping students to see the implications of the faith, and to help them to see, well, this is why we have, you know, particular codes of conduct. Schools also don't go around digging into what students do outside hours unnecessarily. But the fact is, if you've got a situation where, say, students came to the religious school and said, we want to set up a gay pride club or something like that to support homosexual activity, and the school said, well, that's inconsistent with our religious ethos. And if students then persist with that, then there'd be issues as to what the school could do. You know, could they apply detention or something like that? And this is the sort of, I guess this is one of those issues where this law will have something of an impact. So just to go to the legal details, Section 82A, I was talking to you before, capital A, is about staffing decisions. Section 82.2 is amended by the law to say that decisions that the school makes in other areas, say, or that a body makes in other areas, have to be not only based on their doctrines, belief, and principles, or reasonably necessary to avoid injury to religious sensitivities, but they also have to be reasonable and proportionate. So this does then create this extra layer of challenge that could be made to a school's decision in these areas. And again, it will come back to the question of if it has to be litigated, a tribunal or a court deciding, well, was it reasonable or proportionate for the school to apply this policy in these sort of areas? So I guess what I'm saying, and I've ranged a bit over there, but what I'm saying is I don't think schools are just expelling students for sexual orientation. Schools in particular, religious schools, say Christian schools, are very conscious of the difference between, as it were, temptations people may face and activities that engage in behaviour that is regarded as wrong. And so many schools will say, well, you know, you may feel attracted, same-sex attracted, or you may feel, let's take, you know, students who are under 18, you feel like having sex with your girlfriend or your boyfriend. The Bible tells us that that's wrong, and we would encourage you not to do that. And, you know, we're going to help you as the school tries to pastorally care for students, not to behave in ways that our religious community sees as wrong on the basis of God's commands. So those are the sorts of things that I think the school will be wrestling with. You know, there are other views on these matters, of course. And as you say, people that I know in the faith schools area are very conscious of the pressures that students go under and will do their best to help and encourage students. But in the end, it gets very difficult if there's someone wanting to openly agitate for a view that is contrary to a fundamental faith commitment of the organisation.
Right. Okay. I guess another sort of maybe playing devil's advocate sort of argument for these laws is the sort of, you know, he who pays the piper calls the tune sort of argument that religious schools, religious organizations in Australia have been accepting a lot of government money for decades, and that they perhaps shouldn't be surprised that sooner or later the government comes and says, you have to follow these rules when you're taking this money. You know, it's the classic voluntarist objection, you know, in colonial America to having an established church was this fear that money is going to corrupt our beliefs. Do you see any force to that sort of argument?
Well, my view, you know, he who pays the piper calls the tune is a pragmatic description of what happens in the world. I don't think it's a moral argument for sure. Something that should happen. But the bottom line is the funding that's given to, let's start with, say, schools, the funding that's come to schools doesn't come from some magic pot of money in the sky. It's taxpayers' money paid for by the taxes of resident citizens of Australia, over 50% of whom have some commitment to a religious worldview, according to the last census. So, and who have, in my terms, if we want to talk in broad moral terms, a right to have their money spent in partly in accordance with their commitments. So the view that, for example, all money that's spent by the government can never be given to a religious body, I mean, it's just not realistic. It's not, and it's not fair. Religious people in Australia pay taxes. It's reasonable that some of their money be spent on services that they see as important. Now, of course, it's not as straightforward as none of us gets to determine exactly how our tax dollar gets spent by the government. It's played out through the electoral process. It's played out through people getting elected and unelected, as it were, losing elections. You know, the government's policy on these things has been clear. And for many years, and I think one could say pretty clearly, we have a bipartisan policy from both of the major parties in Australia for funding religious schools. And that's been the case since the what's known to us law and religion lawyers as the Dogs case, the case in 1981, which said it wasn't contrary to the prohibition on establishment of religion in Australia for the government's money to go in an even-handed way to religious schools to pay for their education of students in non-religious subjects, but to go to those schools and allow them to, you know, pay for the other stuff. So generally speaking, I don't agree with this idea. Actually, the government of Australia has relied on the the voluntary work of religious organisations to provide services to people in many cases where the government would have had to pay for those services at a much greater rate. And so religious charities that are serving the poor, religious groups that are offering services in all sorts of ways are actually providing assistance to people. And it's, in my view, it is not the case that that people, you know, should demand that government money never be spent on a group that happens to be motivated, as many groups are, by religion. And the fact is that religious groups providing services to needy people in our community do not generally distinguish between people on moral or religious grounds. You know, the Salvation Army provides its services to you whether you are a Muslim or a Hindu or a Christian, and they will, you know, serve you sausage sandwiches or whatever and provide clothes and all those sorts of things to people who are in need. It's generally not something where services are provided to the general public where there'll be any discrimination based on whether someone's gay or straight, whether someone's black or white, whether someone's male or female. There may be one or two organisations who do provide specific services to specific groups. I mean, sometimes there might be, for example, a Jewish relief organisation that will provide specific relief to people who are from the Jewish background, or one or two areas like that. But it's very mostly organisations that provide services to the public will provide it on an even-handed basis. But the legislation here does impose a specific obligation under Section 82 capital B, where it's a religious body that provides government-funded goods or services. And it, you know, it says that you can't distinguish, you can't discriminate against somebody except if it's in accordance with your doctrine and it's reasonable and proportionate. And to be honest with you, I think 82 capital B will be hardly ever used, if ever. Because, as I say, I think it's very hard to find examples of social services being provided to the general public where those are provided on a discriminatory basis or whether the decisions are made. Now, you know, a charity will make decisions about its own staffing. The Salvation Army, for example, will employ people probably from the Salvation Army Church or who agree with its doctrines. The Catholic Church will do the same. The Sikhs will do the same in terms of the providers of the services, but the beneficiaries of the services, there's usually no discrimination in providing those things. So I don't think Section 82 capital B will be much relied on in any case.
Do you think the employee aspects of the new law or the parts referencing students, do you think one of those two is going to, or both of them are going to be deemed problematic by religious groups? Or
yes, I think there's going to be an impact. I think partly depending on how much litigation ensues, but we've seen that it's in this day and age, there are people prepared to take cases to make points about these things. Yeah. If a religious school is told that they have to subject their decision-making about staff to the review of an external tribunal on what's inherent requirement and what's reasonable and what's proportionate, and that decision-making can only be based on religious commitments formally as opposed to other issues, there will be some religious schools that I think will say we can't operate in that way. We are set up to operate in accordance with a particular worldview based on a particular faith, and you are preventing us from doing that. And there'll be parents who will say, well, I'm sending my children to this school because I want them to live out a particular faith worldview. If they can't, there's no point in me spending my money sending my child to this school. I'll either send them to the public school or I'll teach them at home. and of course, homeschooling is not a huge thing in Australia, but it has been growing. And I think that there are parents who might take those sort of decisions. So I think it is potentially something that may have an impact in this area. Yeah.
For groups opposed to law, do you think, are they going to just have to grapple with this on a sort of case-by-case basis? Or is there some other way that they, can have this law change or alter it or weaken? I mean, you mentioned obviously there's the ballot box. We don't have in Australia a constitutional guarantee of freedom of association. We know that Section 116 doesn't apply to the states. Mm. Do you foresee some other type of litigation to try and really attack the heart of this new law? Or is it just something that's going to have to be dealt with, case by case?
Well, there is a possibility of a challenge to parts of the law on the basis of a clash with Commonwealth law. There are a couple of different ways that might happen. Let me start with the more general one. Section 109 of the Constitution says that where the Commonwealth law clashes with state law, the Commonwealth law will prevail. And there's different ways that the courts have unpacked Section 109 over the years. But one of the strands of reasoning on Section 109 decisions is if the Commonwealth gives a right and that is taken away by state law, then that's a clash. The states can't take away a right that's given to someone under the law of the Commonwealth. Now, one could argue, and I've made the argument once or twice in some papers that I've prepared, but I know there's a bit of debate about this, but my argument is that under the Commonwealth law at the moment, the Sex Discrimination Act of the Commonwealth, Section 37, has the effect of what, broadly speaking, the current Victorian law has. Section 37 and 38 of the Commonwealth Sex Discrimination Act allow schools and religious bodies to make decisions based on their religious ethos in broad terms, without the extra requirements of necessary, proportionate and inherent, all those sorts of things that are added by the new Victorian law. I think one could take the view that actually gives a right to faith-based schools to operate in accordance with their ethos. The way that the structure of the legislation is set up is that it's a balancing of different rights, and the schools under Commonwealth law are given a right to operate in accordance with their ethos. If the Victorian law takes that right away in relation to people who may be sued under the Victorian law, I think there could be an argument that the Victorian law is invalid to the extent that it makes it harder for someone to exercise a right that they're given to a school to exercise a right they're given under Commonwealth law.
I think you've just given me a great hypothetical for my next constitutional law exam.
Well, thank you.
That's a really interesting argument you make, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that's one general way that there could be a challenge. And look, it hasn't actually come up in precisely this way so far, but I can, if you read some of my stuff, or if you email me, I'll give you a link to a few other cases where in other areas of life, including criminal law, if the Commonwealth criminal law sets up certain rules, the state's harsher, the High Court has said, no, the Commonwealth law is the one that should apply. So that's one. But there's a second, one, and we can talk about this or you might want to leave it, that arises under the current package of religious discrimination laws that's been put up to federal parliament. And because of concerns that people have had about the Victorian religious exemptions law, there is a provision in one of those bills that will allow the Commonwealth law to override the Victorian law in certain areas. And it actually names the Victorian Religious Exemptions Act in what's called the Consequential Amendments Bill that's been put up by in the federal parliament at the moment. Now, the override there would be in a limited way, basically under Section 11 of the Religious Discrimination Bill. A religious group is allowed to preference staff with their religious views for employment. Now, if religious groups said, okay, we want the gardener to be someone who goes to one of our churches or something like that, one of our groups shares our religious view, you can imagine the Victorian law saying, no, that's not going to work because that's not an inherent requirement or it's not necessary or proportionate. In those circumstances, if the religious discrimination bill that's been put up by the Commonwealth goes forward, then there would be an actual explicit override of that Victorian provision. But it would only apply to that question of religious staff being, having a religious requirements attached to their position. So yeah, there's a possibility in the future that may also be litigated if that goes through. But of course, we no means sure that the current package of religious discrimination laws will go through the parliament, given that it's subject to two separate parliamentary inquiries at the moment.
That's right. Yeah. As we're recording, it's an open question whether that will happen. And it may depend on the election in 2022. I guess we'll have to wait and see. But it's definitely an interesting and important aspect of that federal law, if it can be used to displace some of these, the Victorian scheme or other state schemes in the way you describe. To wrap up, the my final sort of question for you is, in an article in November, Patrick Parkinson from the University of Queensland, he wrote a piece on the Victorian law for the ABC Religion and Ethics Law Report website. And he said, it's increasingly difficult to interpret the government's track record in any other way except as motivated by hostility to people who hold strong religious beliefs. And he goes on, but I guess, do you see it in the same way? Do you see this bill as motivated by hostility, or how would you characterize, I guess, the environment and what's going on in Victoria from your point of view?
Well, you know, I'm almost tempted to what do we call it, plead the fifth here. I mean, I'm a lawyer and I'm not a politician, of course, but I have a view on these things, and I have to say my view generally accords with Professor Parkinson's view. We have a track record of the current Victorian government enacting legislation which really overrides religious freedom in a number of ways. Certainly we have the conversion practices law, which while it's very complicated, I think it goes way too far in overriding ordinary religious practices. It, obviously no one supports the horrific, you know, electrodes in the brains and severest drug therapy and various things that was done. But anyway, we won't go into that. But I think that itself is legislation that will make it very difficult for religious people in some areas. Mm. We have this law. We have other laws that have been enacted in Victoria, which have not given much recognition to religious freedom in things like abortion. Voluntary dying legislation, which doesn't really recognise religious freedom in many ways. So it doesn't seem to be coincidental that rights that have been traditionally regarded as important rights to live out one's faith have been ignored or overridden in some legislation that's been put through by the current Victorian government. And that will have been done with what they perceive to be good motives, I'm sure. The impact of that is quite serious on people who are wanting to live out their faith in Victoria.
Okay, and I know you said you're a lawyer and not a political scientist, but do you have a suspicion of why that lack of understanding or hostility, why that exists? Is it maybe just too, the MPs are too secular, or is there something else going on there that you think is motivating what's perceived as hostility, at least by thinkers?
I mean, we have a world where, again, getting into waters that are really more philosophical than my expertise, but we have a world where people's identities become very important to themselves, and many people will see it as really crucial that they be allowed to define their own identity. And often identity is defined in some circles through affiliation with questions about sexuality or gender. And when you move in that direction, your willingness to define your identity in that way, anyone who disagrees with moral choices that seem to inexorably go along with that identity is seen then as attacking you as a person. And so opposition to moral opposition to certain practices is seen as hate for individuals. And the traditional view of theologians and Christians for many years is that we're all sinners. We're all people who have broken God's law. We're all people who have done the wrong thing, but we have the opportunity to change. We have an opportunity to repent. And our identity is not shaped by our moral choices in that sense of in a particular area. I don't have, for example, if I'm tempted to steal, I don't have to call myself a thief, and you know, the thief becomes my identity. Now, that in itself, what I've said to you there will be offensive to people. unfortunately, and I'm sorry if that's the case, but it is the case that the Christian worldview, the Bible, the source of doctrine, says that certain sexual practices are not in accordance with God's will. But people see those things as a fundamental part of their personal identity. And so it gets very hard to reconcile these two worldviews. And I think what we're seeing in this area is a sort of clash between these different worldviews, which is very hard to resolve. And what I'm hoping for and what I would like to encourage is tolerance and toleration, in the sense of being willing to put up with people whose views you fundamentally disagree with on the basis of living together in a state of harmony, and allowing people the maximum freedom to live out their commitments, so long as they're not doing so in a way which harms others. But of course, then we have the definition of harm. Mm. Does it harm me to know that someone disagrees with my moral choices? Well, those are the sorts of things I think that we're still wrestling with.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that. I think, as you say, if there is a clash of values or a clash of identities, hopefully at some point in the future, we can find reconciliation between them and move forward in that way. I think this new law is a development that will play out over the next couple of years, especially if we get a Commonwealth religious discrimination law. It'll be really interesting to see, I guess, a legal perspective, how that's evolved as well. But thanks so much for coming on the show and speaking with me today, Neil.
That's all right. It's been a pleasure, Jeremy.
Listeners, if you have questions, comments, or topic suggestions, please email me at jeremy.patrick@usq.edu.au. I'll be back in 2 months with another episode of Law and Religion Down Under. See you then.